This is CliffCentral.com.
Colin Coleman is one of South Africa's most prominent people in finance. He is in studio to chat about his most recent and kind of shocking announcement. He's retired as Sub-Saharan Africa's CEO of the storied investment banking group Goldman Sachs, and he's taking up an academic post while promising to stay involved in South Africa and our economy. Colin, I've known you for a long time, but it's interesting to talk to you about this period of flux in the country's story and in your own, where you've decided to go and give back in the form of lecturing at Yale. It's no small step.
I always smile when people say it's shocking that I retire after 20 years. I mean, I'm basically going to become a fossil if I stay there any longer.
And especially in Goldman Sachs, that reputation for people who work at and for the culture of Goldman Sachs, is it really what people think it is on the outside? Because you guys are seen as the most maverick, ruthless, just unbelievably strenuous environment to work in.
What's absolutely true is the hardworking intensity of Goldman Sachs. You know, people get paid very well, but it's really, you know, the best brains that you collect around you and work incredibly hard. In fact, you know, I have an interviewing style with the people that come into Goldman Sachs, and Goldman Sachs is rather famous for an extensive interview process. You know, if you go through 30 people in your interviews, it's kind of standard. You know, that sounds like an incredible sort of filter to get through, but 30 people is pretty standard. At the end of the 30 people, they probably come to me and I would say to them, you now before me in your interview process because you're a great person and you're technically capable and you're up to the task and you're one of the best postgraduate students and, you know, you're at the beginning of your career and everything else, but I just want to talk to you about your character, because when it comes down to it, you know, you're going to come to me in a year or two's time having grilled many all-nighters, having had a sustained, intense experience of work. And you're going to come to me and say, Colin, I just can't do this anymore. I've got to take some time out. And I'm going to tell you to go back to your desk, because right now I'm telling you this moment's going to come. Sure. And, you know, people work so intensely. I'm talking particularly the analyst and associate level, the first, you know, 3 to 6 years of your career. They're working incredibly hard. The good part of it is they're getting an incredible training. They're getting, you know, deal flow experience, and they're going to come out of it just very rounded bankers set for the future. And that's when you start to build bankers who can go and originate, engage with clients, and come back with ideas and run projects and become fantastic assets to the firm going forward. But that is an intense place to work.
But you've probably seen a lot of really, really strong people come and go over your time at Goldman Sachs.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I've built literally when I arrived in August 2000, I was the only banker on the ground. And now we have around 50 people, about 15 on the security side and the balance on the banking side. You know, it's building one person at a time. That's been 20 years. You know, and these people rotate. Some people go on mobility to London or New York or to Australia, in my experience. But over time, you're adding incrementally net one person sort of a year over a 20-year period, and you've got a great team of people, and you just see these people come. Some people don't cope in the end and leave to go to local banks or change careers or go to private equity or that sort of thing, which is fine. And then others who kind of really face down those daunting moments I've referred to and continue in their careers. And, you know, there's one guy that started off with me as an analyst. He's now in Australia as a vice president, doing fantastically in the mining space. And I hope one day he'll come back, and I'm convinced he'll be a partner of the firm one day. And I told him that right at the beginning. I said, you've got what it takes.
Can you spot them immediately?
Yeah,
you say they go through this process, which I understand all companies do that, but it is a different culture at Goldman Sachs. You have earned this reputation as a business. Can you, when they walk through your door for the first time, do you have a good sense of whether or not this person's going to stay the distance?
Yeah, if they don't feel like they're going to stay the distance, we don't hire them. But the people that that come, you know, most of them stay the distance and most of them cut it. Some move out of, you know, Goldman Sachs, South Africa or Africa into different roles. But that's absolutely fine. We're a global firm. So, you know, we creating talent, which is fantastic.
Let's go back a little bit further, though.
Sure.
You've been a vocal advocate your whole life of certain values, certain virtues and traditions that I think you take very seriously, and you've brought them into your corporate life as well. You, as a young student, were a big anti-apartheid activist. This is at a time where it was actually personally quite dangerous to be so. Even if you were white, you were putting yourself in harm's way and you were putting yourself at risk, where you could have had a quiet and comfortable existence being smart and being attuned to what was going on around you. You could have lived a very quiet and pleasant life and have made lots of money, as so many people did. But you decided at this young age, or just the passion overtook you, to be an activist of a kind. How do you think you thought about it then? How do you think about it now? And would you go back and change anything?
No, I think that, as you say, that sort of core principle, that core value system, that's driven not just me, but my family into an anti-apartheid, pro-democracy value system that's sustained through this, you know, my 57 years, you know, has been, you know, very much the platform on which my life has been built. you know, I would say, when looking back at those years, there were two things at play. One is, you know, I came from a liberal progressive family. I always knew, you know, in my childhood, I was a tennis player and a normal sportsman, and I was very active. But I always knew that there was something very dark and disturbing about the setup in South Africa under apartheid, that the people that you most loved, who looked after you, your domestic workers, had to take an identity document and were often stopped in the streets outside the home. It was because they were black. It was, you know, very disturbing and dark as a concept for a young person who believed in the goodness of people. And, you know, was certainly when I was 18, when my brother was detained by the security police for anti-apartheid journalism in 1981, that, you know, the reality of this not being a concept but being a vicious repressive system came home to my family and to propelled us into that world. I mean, you know, it was at the time my brother was in solitary confinement for 6 months in John Forster Square, and he happened to be in the cell next to Neil Agut, who was brutally tortured and committed suicide. And it was only after Neil Agut committed suicide that these detainees, there were about 50 progressive, white, colored, Indian, African detainees who were in prison at the same time, were released. And then he was banned. He was a journalist, a young journalist student, and he was not allowed to be with more than one person at the same point in time.
Yeah. Illegal
in
gatherings.
The home. It was illegal gatherings, the Anti-Terrorism Act, and so on. So the reality of that time was so overwhelming, and it sort of pushed us, you know, into the anti-apartheid movement. Sure. And obviously, as a student, I was an architecture student at the time. We all had to, as white South Africans, go through the exemption process of the South African National Defence Force. At the time, you were conscripted, and if you went to university, it was a way to get exempted. We came to the conclusion at some point amongst democratic white South Africans that we couldn't hide behind the exemption system, and there were a number of us that basically said we were going to not go to the SANDF.
Conscientious objectors.
For political reasons, which was a criminal offense at the time.
Right.
And there were about 160 white South Africans from around the country that did that. That, you know, you mentioned that there was a fear factor in what we were doing at the time. That was actually one of my most fearful moments, that, you know, you could be put in criminal jail for basically being a political objector to the system of conscription. So that
and you're a young person with your whole life ahead of you, you know, and you can see that perhaps that's the time where you might want to flee overseas and get yourself an education there and start a career, and maybe you want to start a family and all that kind of thing. So you've got a lot on the line.
Yeah, and there was, you know, a number of people. There were some heroes like David Bruce, Ivan Toms, these very, you know, not so well known, but famous in the anti-apartheid movement, went to criminal jails and experienced what it was like to be in criminal jail for you know, not wanting to go into the townships serving the South African Defence Force at the time. And these people are unsung heroes in South Africa today. But, you know, I mean, it's true that I would say, you know, thinking through the intensity of that time, the underground movement of the ANC, the United Democratic Front, the National Education Crisis Committee, all of the issues that were going on the campuses, and then in the lead up to the negotiation time, was fantastic training ground. We met incredible people. The networks that I have today were very much based on the networks I established then. And, you know, there was a lot of huge amount of benefit to doing that. And in my business career, it stood me in fantastic stead. But I've always been a hard worker. I must say, I was looking through some documents the other day because I'm trying to work out what documents to take with me to Yale University, which I'll be teaching about some of these subjects. And, you know, looking at the intensity of what I did in the democratic movement, in the constitutional negotiations, in getting business to be an active force in the democratic process, pre the negotiations and post the negotiations, and then at Standard Bank and JP Morgan, you know, I've constantly been working hard. This is probably the first time I'm going to be able to step back a little bit and smell the roses. I'm not sure I'll be, you know, stopping too much, but it's gonna, you know, I've lived an intense life for sure.
Well, there are lots of people that we can talk about that you mentioned tangentially now as being people who are part of your network. I mean, your network is extensive internationally and locally. One of the people who's been through the Goldman Sachs machine is Tito Mboweni, who's now our finance minister. And I know you've always had a close relationship with him. You've always been respectful of the distance that needs to be kept between politics and business, but you've also been one of those people who's made it a much closer degree of relationship and of friendship when it needed to be. And I think in this country, probably we've got a very interesting case study. Maybe this forms part of what you'll lecture. A case study for the world about how business can be involved in society and in politics in a positive and constructive way. Because there are lots of people who view them as being at polar opposites, especially in a country where we have a left-leaning socialist bent in many of the structures within the ANC, certainly the Communist Party, the unions, and they're vehemently, from a historical point of view, anti-business, and that needed to be bridged for us to get somewhere, right?
No, absolutely. I think, you know, I know you're a deep philosopher, Gareth, so you might and your listeners might enjoy this thought, but I've been deeply thinking about the nature of society today, the nature of government, and the nature of business, and what are the skills in government, what are the skills in business. In brief, business really knows how to execute projects, you know, has deep expertise around building things, about executing large-scale projects, getting things done. And government tends to attract people who are policy people, people who care about the future of the world, care about the future, the direction of society, but they tend not to have the skills that are in business. Business people tend not to understand policy and tend to get irritated with the realm of policy and
the wastage. They see resources being deployed without real discipline.
Yeah.
And in business, that bears a cost, which sometimes means people lose their income. It means businesses fold. There aren't always those consequences for politicians.
And then on the other side, the politicians look at business and say, look, they're elites.
Yeah.
They're exclusionary.
Profiteering.
They profiteer. They don't take society into account. The people who are inside are fine. The people who are outside the system are not so fine. And so, you know, the truth is there's a huge amount of truth to the fact that the skills in business are skills that the politicians need. And the skills in politics are some of the skills that business people need.
Sounds like yin and yang. So you almost found a reason for each to need the other.
Absolutely. And I've been fortunate in my career to be able to twin these skills because I've had a lot of exposure to politics and to the world of the transition. And I've had a huge amount of exposure to the kind of mainstream of the economy, what makes it tick and how you get investment done. But if you take a step back, my critique at the moment, which I'm hoping to do a lot more studying about, is that the world society right throughout the world, and we're seeing this huge rise in nationalism, populism, this alienation of people from the world of the economy, is that our system of democratic government is very much based on something that was 5,000 years old called the Roman Empire.
Yeah, well, even before that, in ancient Greece.
But if you look at the Romans and the way they ran government, you know, effectively to today, it's not much different today as it was in that system. So what we need is we need a constitutionally driven society with politicians who are driving constitutional behavior. And we've had recent cases where actually the politicians were driving against the Constitution, not in favor of it, under the Zuma administration. But you need a Cyril Ramaphosa-styled constitutionalism that drives the politics, but you need the skill set that's in the private sector to populate the government in a professional bureaucracy that gets things done. You think about how frustrated society is in South Africa with the lack of delivery system, the consumptive nature of the civil service, millions of people in the civil service who are earning salaries but not producing commensurate with what they're getting paid. And so there's a lot of frustration with the system of government.
Well, you and I have, again, we're going off on tangents here, but that's okay. We'll come back to your story in a minute. But you've been a massive supporter and champion of Cyril for a long time. You've supported him from the point of view of South African business, but you've also supported him knowing him more intimately than many of us do. And you and I have had some conversations about that where you've either put me in my place or that I've been prepared to listen, where you've said to me, you know, it is a long game and there is a lot going on. There are many moving parts here. And what politicians often have to do is they have to try to satisfy various constituencies all at once. And sometimes those constituencies are at polar opposites. It's almost as if, taking from what you've just said now, if we could implement a system where the politicians were elected the way that they are, but the directors general were chosen by people like you, for example, we would almost end up with a slightly more technocratic, and I mean that in a positive sense, not a negative one, and functional and productive bureaucracy. And the politicians could do what they do. They could dream and visualize and come up with policy. And everything would be satisfied maximally. Do you think that that's almost like the kind of system we should aspire to have and that we can start implementing it in drips and drabs all over the world?
Yeah, I think the transmission belt between what and who is elected and who is operating the functional arms of government, you're touching on that. There's something in there that needs to be redefined and transformed. But there's also another layer which is, I think, not touched, certainly not in South Africa, and that's the layer of, you know, what needs to be managed by public servants and what can be managed online.
Oh, yeah.
Think about it. I mean, a visa system, a tax system, all your electrical bills, many of your choices that you make about what services you're getting should be competitive, should be a source of differentiation.
And the payback for a government would be the enormous amount of data that they could gather from that would enable them to do all the human things better. But absolutely, these are things that artificial intelligence and machine learning could do a lot faster and a lot more effectively than humans. And wouldn't it be a pleasure if you could get your bills from the municipality without someone having incorrectly added them up or put them out at the wrong time or sent out late or whatever, and people could manage themselves that way?
Yeah, so I mean, I'm hearing stories. There's Estonia apparently got a lot of services online. Italy is moving in that direction. Sweden, you know, has a far less number of government employees in the federal administration than you would think. So, you know, do we need to have a million plus public servants in this country? Probably not. Probably not. So I think we need to try and redefine what is government. And as you said earlier, redefine the electoral process, defining who becomes politicians and who becomes the administration. And I think there's a level of frustration in the world, but certainly in South Africa, with this question of the quality of the administration. And this is separate from who is the party running the government and so on and so forth. I mean, look at the DA. So, you know, the ANC runs the national government, the DA runs Johannesburg. If you had to have a referendum about just the quality of the administration of Johannesburg, I guess it's been better, it's been worse at certain times, but there would certainly be a hot discussion about can that quality of administration be improved?
Well, let's just focus on what we brought in here now, because you have been a champion of Cyril. How do you think he's doing? He's 2 years in, and he's still struggling with huge factionalism within his own party. He has implemented things which are tangibly making a difference, but the economy is suffering. And I've seen you very outspoken on any number of media outlets, locally and internationally. The last time I saw you, I think, on MSNBC, talking about how the future economically looks for South Africa. And there are a lot of people who are very concerned about the state of the economy right now. And people who might read your leaving Goldman Sachs because they have a point of view already, and this is going to fit into their point of view, as you kind of getting out too. That's not what's going on with you, right?
Okay, let me address the second part first, which is I'm splitting my time. When I'm not in South Africa, I'm going to be occupied with South Africa. So if I'm in New York teaching at Yale, it's very much about Africa. If I'm going to be writing, it's about my South Africa experience. So there's no question. I've lived offshore, by the way, before. I was at JP Morgan for 3 years in London, came back. So this is kind of a period, I would guess, of 2 years or so where I'm going to be in a post-Goldman Sachs transition, repivoting my positioning, my time to writing, publishing, thinking about these very issues that we've just talked about, but also you know, going on some boards, which I'll announce in due course, and consulting and being actively engaged in and around South Africa.
Is there any kind of restraint on you after you've left Goldman Sachs?
Effectively, no. I mean, I will, you know, obviously do what I need to do in relation to Goldman Sachs, but there's no restraints of trade on me. I will retain stock, so my stock will have restraints in terms of, you know, my behavior insofar as Goldman Sachs is concerned.
But you're not going to suddenly go out and become their arch enemy for obvious reasons.
So I think within reason, there's no real constraints on
it. All right, and then the first part of the question, and the economy.
So the first part of the question, I mean, Cyril himself, okay, and all patriotic South Africans cannot be happy with a 0.5% growth rate, 39%, you know, broad unemployment. No. Let's put it in numbers: 16.5 million people working, 9.5 million people who want to work cannot find work. That is and the level of inequality we have in South Africa, that is a cocktail that no one can be happy with.
No.
So, if you are to ask the question to the president about, is the president happy with the progress? Of course, he's not going to be happy with the progress, and we can't be happy with the progress. And the question is, how is he doing within the constraints he has? And I would say, you know, my own counsel would be to be more risk-taking with regards to modernizing the party, getting rid of the negative elements in the party. I mean, I'm on various people's Facebook of people who are working in the Secretary General's office of the ANC. And, you know, within 5 minutes of the Eskom announcement coming out, you had the ANC saying, we support the appointment of Ando de Reiter as the CEO of Eskom. And then you have another arm of the Secretary General's office basically posting something from the Young Professionals Association condemning it. And, you know, that kind of behavior, I think, is unacceptable myself. So I think that you need to modernize the party in order to modernize the country.
Yeah.
Because this is the ruling party. So if we want to get structural reforms in place, you know, we have to get that moving. There's some structural reforms that I think the president is undertaking where he's frustrated because of the administration, not because of the politics. So, for example, the spectrum implementation or the implementation of visa arrangements, which are two important things. They're just taking too long.
Yeah.
And my impression is this is not because of political blocking. It's because of administrative bungling. But there's certain areas, for example, crowding in the private sector, which is critically important. The Tito Mboweni paper you've mentioned, you know, I think he's done a fantastic job.
And
the
also
finance
came
minister
under considerable criticism
came
from
under
within
huge
the ANC.
Criticism, but
not the, constructive criticism, I might add.
Well, I think that he managed it quite well. So he effectively threw this grenade into the middle of the ANC debating chamber, you know, of his effectively pro-private sector economic growth plan. And, you know, he's managed the fallout in the party, and the party has kind of moderated the plan with him. And I think basically the plan is intact. And what he's done is he's seized the economic policy realm
right.
from others in the government who had a different vision of the economy. So he's done incredibly well, and the president's now backed him. So I think what we have there, but you know, let's just kind of look at it a second, is the crowding out of the private sector into ports, into energy and in particular independent power producers,
right?
Into rail and various things. And actually, if you cast your mind back, as I was this weekend reading papers that I did when I was at Standard Corporate Merchant Bank from 94 to 97, we created an infrastructure fund then, and we were doing the toll roads that people don't like today so much. But the fact is, the toll roads were a function of Mac Maharaj, Ketso Gordon, Nazir Ali in the 94 period, you know, concessioning out toll roads then. And there was a huge amount of dynamism, actually, under the Mandela and Mbeki era of bringing in private sector into the economy. And that, you know, was resisted by people like Alec Owen, who didn't want to see the private sector come into ports at that stage. He may have changed with getting a bit older and getting
wiser.
Today he probably thinks that that was a bad mistake. But, you know, he was somebody that played a big role in the decisions around Eskom in the mid-2000s.
Well, I remember he was Minister of Public Enterprises when we started with all the load shedding.
Mm-hmm.
And people have a short memory.
Yeah.
You know, they ascribe this to the last three ministers, but that public enterprises portfolio is a poison chalice.
Yeah.
And this fear of the private sector is something which I think is also an inherited legacy, something which the ANC struggles with internally, and you would know this better than me. But it seems to me that there are very few examples in the world of things that government runs better than the private sector. There are obviously areas that the private sector can't run, the military, certain parts of public healthcare and public education, infrastructure. There are things there that you can be in partnership with the private sector in, but that government has to kind of take the lead in.
Yeah, so, I mean, modernizing the economy, modernizing South Africa, and crowding in the private sector into these enterprises is a no-brainer. There's a noose around the president's neck, and it's called state-owned enterprises.
Well, Eskom is the single biggest millstone.
It's draining
for him, right?
Fiscally, it's draining operationally, and it's a labor source of huge amounts of conflict. We just saw the SAA strike, and we haven't got into the Eskom labor restructuring yet. So I think this is a huge area,
but it's an absolute no-brainer for him. On that note, what do you think is going to happen with the unions? I mean, unions are at a weaker point than they've almost ever been in post-democratic South Africa. Their influence is waning largely. You've got people like Zwelinzi Mavavi who've made it a source of their own personal security more than anything else. The unions are also big investors back into the economy now because they take those membership fees and they turn them into investments. And so you've got the unions working both as the employers and employees and speaking with forked tongue. You know, in a board meeting, they'll go for the profits. But when it comes to representing the workers, they'll say, oh, those profiteering people on the board, who are often them.
So the Cassata of the Jayendra Naidus in the 1980s, you know, Sam Shiloh, Vavi, you know, up until the splitting of Cassata into Namsa and the rest, was essentially, you know, much more a political activist, intellectually driven, thoughtful, and disciplined union movement that was radical and militant.
And a huge contributor to ANC power, both at election time and within when it came to policy discussion.
Yeah, and I think a militant but constructive force in society. What we have now is effectively three union movements. We have Cassata, that's a public sector union. When you strip it all away, their power base is in the state. So they're in alliance, political alliance, with the government that is its employer. And so that's very, very difficult for the unions and for the government to manage.
Yeah.
Then you have AMCU, which is an EFF-aligned militant union, but kind of in a different direction. And you have NAMSA, which is an anti-ANC body that is, again, a militant union, more styled on the old industrial unions of the 1980s, actually, than Cassata is. So these are, in aggregate, in totality, a source of potential instability in South Africa. So we don't have a disciplined union movement that's consistent with the ANC, even though Cassata is in alliance. They're effectively oppositional to the government, who is the ruling party.
And we saw that when they played the role that they did in Jacob Zuma.
Yes, you know. And that, you know, that has kind of played out. So we have the president now whose political support base is quite thin relative to the pro-Zuma movement today in the ANC. And Cassata is arguably a sort of a swing factor. So he's got to make some judgments. And I must say, you were asking me earlier about the president. Whatever we think, and we the armchair guys, you know, in the studio talking about this stuff, he gets into the union buildings every day or into his offices every day, and he's got to make the basic political judgment. You know, what do I need to do here to move the ball forward, to modernize South Africa, but to keep my constituency along the way? It's no good him performing a Thabo Mbeki where, and he drives the modernization like Thabo does, but he loses the political base, which is exactly what's happened in Argentina.
Yeah.
You know, we've gone back to the Kirchner model of government in Argentina after having a technocratic person modernizing Argentina. He didn't last very long. So the president has to make these judgments, and we have to respect it.
All right. So you're positive and optimistic generally in terms of the fact that you think things are moving forward, but it may take a lot longer than we anticipate, and we've got to get growth up. But do you think there is a basic enough understanding? And again, you're the perfect person for me to ask about this, because you have enough people in the ANC who you're familiar with and who you know well. Are there enough people who understand basic supply and demand economics in the ANC? Because we've got a shrinking tax base. We've wasted enormous amounts of money in public enterprises and in other places. There's enormous endemic corruption across municipalities. I think the Statistician General the other day put out a report which is, it's just outrageous, the amount of looting that's going on. 93% of the municipalities in South Africa are bankrupt. Do we have enough people who understand economics?
Definitely not. I would say the level of understanding is in the ANC on aggregate is probably better than you think, but not sufficient. And when I say not sufficient, I would say if you look at the demographic, and I was at the conference at NASREC, of who is the ANC base, who are the 5,000 people who pitch up at NASREC to elect the leadership people after the filters of, you know, deciding who gets to go from the branches. It's effectively, you look at that crowd, it's pretty young. So I would guess that it would be good to have some statistical analysis of this, but I would guess the average age would be 40.
Okay.
I would guess that 95% is African, of the African National Congress, 5% whites, Indians, and coloured. My guess is that 1/3 of those will be unemployed. My guess is another third will be in the state, and another third will be in some mix of small business and a few in the corporate sector. So the when you aggregate that number and you say how many are getting, you know, mainstream large company private experience who are ANC members pitching up to elect the leader, it's a small fraction. And that has to change. There are a couple of things that has to change. ANC needs to become more non-racial, which means people like us need to support and be visible and be there much more aggressively, not give up the game and say, okay, we don't like this, we're leaving. And actually, Jesse Duarte, interestingly,
said exactly this just a few days ago.
Very, you know, outspoken about the ANC not drawing on its non-racial roots enough. And I thought that was a very encouraging statement from her.
So number one, be more non-racial.
Yeah, I think number one, you know, the ANC needs to be non-racial. And then secondly, we also need to understand that the reality for those people there is that the, let's call it the economics of Zuma, the Zuma economics, which is, let's define corruption as, you know, think differently. Let's not think of corruption as a single act of one person bribing another, but a system of distributing gains across society by politically awarding people the right to those resources.
It's a kind of a redistribution of wealth.
On a redistributive basis, but according to
a network of patronage.
A political patronage network. Yeah. And that is a very powerful system. And it's why it's so popular in the ANC. Because why? Because half of the people don't have the skills to play the modern democratic, open, transparent game and win.
Yeah.
So if the only way you can win is through, let's call it the patronage system of corruption, then let's elect the patronage system leaders who are going to facilitate our getting money and not having to pay for things that we get in the townships and municipalities and so on. Well, that's why the municipalities are like they are. And so it's a tough game in South Africa to say to these people, you know, as a whole, you know what? We need to play by the rules. We need to grow the economy. We need to distribute that you know, pie through taxation. And by the way, you'll get the benefit.
Yeah, so because that for them, system, that's too long a game to play.
So we have this two-speed society. We have this society of insiders and outsiders. And the outsiders are playing the politics to get their share of the cake. And that's the division in the ANC that we're facing, and that's the division the president has to manage in order to maintain his political power base. And we have to help him in every way we can to modernize the party, make it non-racial. We have to make South Africa modernize itself, you know, try and bring e-systems of government into play, reduce the public sector wage bill. And that's what, you know, everybody's looking to the finance minister to do in February.
Sure.
He cannot present a budget that doesn't cut expenditure by 50 billion. And the only way he's going to get that is public sector wages.
But there'll be an outrage.
So that's the trade-offs. And, you know, South Africa has so far in its history of 25 years has been very good at negotiating trade-offs, even if we've come close to the abyss, which I witnessed in 1994. I negotiated with Mandela Buthelezi and de Klerk to get the Inkatha Freedom Party into the election. There were a million lives at stake. We were told there was
enough war imminent.
There was enough arms stoked in the hostels of PW, what was called the PWV Gauteng and KwaZulu-Natal at the time, to cause a massive flare-up. And we stared down a Rwanda genocide in South Africa, and we negotiated an outcome that saw the IFP come in. And actually, not that much has changed, you know, in terms of the political balance since then. The ANC is still in the 50s, the DA is still in the 20s, the IFP is still in single digits, you know. And, you know, 25 years later, we now have to negotiate around the economic trade-offs. There's too much unemployment, there's not enough inclusion, there's not enough growth in society, and South Africans have to get going. Yeah. Like the rugby team, we have to work it out. We lost against New Zealand, remember? Does everybody remember that we actually lost against New Zealand in the first round?
Now, there are a number of people who say, and when you talk like this, this is where I love spending time with you, because you are one of the people I used to rely on for fresh and valuable information, and you don't talk shit, so I knew I was getting the real deal. But people were talking about how you might have been going into the world of politics full-time at one point. There were rumors about you taking a post in government. That was never really on the cards for you, though.
Look, I don't know. You know, people speculate, and that was part of the speculation that I heard.
If the president had said to you, please come and, you know, clean up here or sort this out, or you might have done it out of a sense of public service?
Yeah, going into the future, I'm going to be a free person. No? And, you know, I'm going to use my time at the highest form of impact that I can do at that point in time. So if I was asked to do something that was a very high impact, higher impact than being in New York teaching at Yale University for half the time, being here on boards and so on and so forth, I would do that. So I'm pretty open-minded about what I do. Somebody said to me the other day, a business person said, you know, the first half of our lives is about creating success. The second half of our lives is about creating significance. Now, I've had, fortunately, a mix of success and significance in my earlier career, but I think it's true to say that I'm more focused on significance in the last, let's call it 20, 25 years of my career.
Well, among those things that are significant, it's worth just reflecting on. You've been nominated as one of the World Economic Forum's Global Leaders for Tomorrow. You were also a recipient on behalf of the CBM of Harvard Business School's Businessman Statesman Award in 1994, and you were named one of Euromoney's top 10 financing leaders for the 21st century. You also did the Chinese ICBC stake in Standard Bank deal and the SAB Miller sale to InBev. Maybe InBev. I mean, these are not small things. These have shaken parts of the world that are supposedly unshakable. These are massive, massive achievements and deals.
No, I appreciate it.
You go home at night and you feel quite satisfied, I'm sure, after doing something like that.
Yeah, no, I've been fortunate to be at, you know, at certain things that have really made a contribution. I think actually the South Africa Infrastructure Fund, 800 million rand of equity when I was at Standard Bank, I'd put in that category.
Right.
When I was at JP Morgan, we merged VIAG and Weber, the two largest German utilities, to form a company called E.ON, which I advised on a $16 billion transaction before I left JP Morgan. At Goldman Sachs, you know, whether it was the BOE acquisition or sale to Nedbank at the time, the Absa Barclays deal, the Vodafone Vodacom deal, Walmart Massmart, you know, those are all massive strategic deals. And then of late, you know, the SAB InBev and the Prosus listing by Naspers, which we did this year, which was a fantastic transaction. But I must say, I think the ICBC Standard Bank deal stands out because it really was changing the imagination of what can happen in emerging markets. Nobody anticipated a Chinese bank buying a 20% stake for $5.5 billion in a local South African bank. It happened just prior to the global financial crisis, and it capitalized Standard Bank, so it was in a healthy state for the global financial crisis. It created a vision and reimagined the relationship between Africa and China. And, you know, I was pretty instrumental in going to China and basically presenting the South African financial system to the Chinese players and saying, you know, this is interesting. And ICBC's chairman, Jing Chang, basically taking up the baton and saying, I'm going to come to South Africa with you and meet the banks, which he did. And then negotiating with Jacko Maria and Derek Cooper this transaction in Beijing within months and announcing it very shortly thereafter was a huge moment. And I'm very proud of that transaction because it was really something that one created from a clean sheet. You know, you know that I'm an architect, and the thing about an architect, when you start off with a blank sheet of paper, you look at it, you're going to create a building from nothing. Like literally your imagination starts with zero. Well, that was that deal. There was nothing. And it was just, I noticed that Thabo Mbeki had gone to China at the end of 2006, along with 54 other African presidents, to meet with the Chinese president. And I thought, oh, this is interesting. There must be something going on between China and Africa that I don't understand, and I better understand it. And by February the following year, I was in Beijing talking to the corporate leaders, care of my Goldman Sachs Chinese counterparts, about, so what is going on, and does this mean that corporates in China, banks, institutions, and so on, have an interest in doing business in Africa? And the answer was absolutely yes.
Yeah,
and we took
right.
it from there.
Well, there are a couple of things about you that are interesting besides this, and many people may or may not know, these things about you. You mentioned architecture, and I mean, you've designed the house that you live in, among other things. But is there a small part of you that still wishes you could do more of that? You also collect amazing art. You've got a real eye for interesting contemporary art.
Yeah, look, in the whole creative side, so architect to jazz music you didn't mention. So I'm going to enjoy quite a lot of jazz in New York while I'm there. And art is, you know, very much my hobby, and I like it that way. I don't have to earn money from my hobby.
And even if you were an architect having to do commissions and then they end up being boring things like parking lots, that's not fair.
Yeah, but I think architects do fabulous fabulous things too. You know, modern cities are full of beautiful architecture, and it's to their credit.
So where are you going to be in New York when you go there?
So, you know, I'm probably going to be in the downtown Manhattan area, renting an apartment there. And I'll be commuting once a week to Yale University for the first 13 weeks and for the last 13 weeks of the year, of the academic year. I will have my kids spread around the world, but my youngest one is in Johannesburg, so I'll come regularly to see him, and he'll come to see me. But I'm really looking forward to spending a bit of time in New York. It's a wonderful city, a very energetic, dynamic, young people. And so that's going to be a terrific experience.
Now, you're also very proud of your kids, and justifiably. I mean, they're all talented and very smart in their own ways too. Do they fully comprehend and appreciate the sort of things that their dad does?
Well, from time to time, they also give me feedback, you know.
But do they just treat you like all kids treat their dads, like someone who's in the way of their fun?
You know, but I guess I've had some fantastic moments. The one that your listeners will be interested in is in 2008, after doing the ICBC Standard Bank deal, which I thought was, you know, historic transaction that was groundbreaking, and then that would pave my way to become a partner of Goldman Sachs. I was told within a few weeks of that I wasn't going to make partner of Goldman Sachs. In fact, I wasn't going to be considered for partner of Goldman Sachs that year. And I went home and I said to my kids, you know, they just don't get it. I'm so annoyed. Should I leave Goldman Sachs? And they looked at me and they said, Dad, maybe you should give them one more chance. And 2 years later, I did make partner at Goldman Sachs in 2010, and that was a fantastic moment. But they've been a great influence on me, and you know, I love them to bits. They're all quite different. My eldest one is a opera singer. She's going to London.
I've seen her sing. She's tremendous,
and she's wonderful. And you know, your listeners will get to hopefully hear of her and see her. My second eldest is at Brown University, quite close to Yale University.
What's she
actually
studying?
She's doing an undergraduate degree, and she's doing everything from neuroscience to feminism and religion and law and theater. But she's very keen on literature and calculus, and she'll get to do that over time. So she's doing this broad undergraduate with incredibly talented people. I think Brown accepts 4% of applicants a year. So it's an incredible institution.
Tremendous.
And then my eldest son is matriculating this week. And he's going to go to Cape Town University next year. So I'll have a spread. And then my youngest, who's six next year, is going to staying in Johannesburg at his current school. They're all wonderful in their own way.
Well, I mean, you're imparting a lot more than just a genetic inheritance to these kids. They also have all grown up with various talents and influences, and also the kind of people that I think you've exposed them to. probably gives them a huge advantage. Mm. It's interesting to me how many people try to have balance in their lives, and it's a hard thing to achieve. With all of this work, with all of these things that you're involved in, and you mentioned earlier that this is probably the first time in your life you've really been able to take a deep breath, step back from having that constant pressure of a very important and I suppose difficult work to do, and really you didn't have any time off. Now, do you think that you're going to take to this and find it pleasant, or is it going to start irritating you that you have time on your hands and maybe you won't do as much writing as you think and you'll want to be back in the room doing deals?
Well, I think it's going to be definitely a different rhythm in my life, and I'm going to have to adjust. I'm not going to have the huge corporate support network that I have right now, and I'll probably have to learn some technological things, do my own health.
What, you mean you don't reply to your own emails?
Do my own health insurance submissions and you know, things like that. But it's going to be fantastic to be able to sit back and reflect and think. You know, Gareth, I think the biggest thing is I'm going to need to think and reflect. You can't just write. You have to write something substantive. And I think
you need time to do the research and the reading as well.
Yeah, and I think the feedback from the students, the teaching, the writing, and then the reflection is going to be very important to my being able to pivot into being a more useful person in the future.
Well, I think South Africa's at least part-time loss here is the international world's gain, and you are certainly not leaving us behind. So you'll be checking in, and we'll be checking in with you. And when we want an objective opinion now, there's absolutely nothing holding you back, so I'm sure we'll see lots of your commentary all over the place as well.
Absolutely. Thanks
Good
very much.
Stuff. Colin, thanks. It's nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you again for everything.
This is CliffCentral.com.